Penguin Random House Audio presents My Mother's Kitchen, Breakfast, Lunch, Dinner, and the Meaning of Life. This is the author, Peter Gethers. Publisher's note, this audiobook includes a bonus PDF of terrific illustrations, great recipes, and photos, many of which have really witty captions that I wrote, which can all be viewed on any PC or Mac computer. When nothing else subsists from the past, the smell and taste of things remain poised a long time like souls, bearing resiliently on tiny and almost impalpable drops of their essence, the immense edifice of memory. Marcel Proust. Part 1. Amuse-Bouche. There is no sincerer love than the love of food. George Bernard Shaw. Chapter 1. I have two distinct images of my mother that I will always carry with me. One is from Christmas 2007, when she was 85 years old. On October 5th of that year, she suffered a massive stroke that hit the absolute center of her brain. In the hospital the next afternoon, a doctor in the ER told me it was likely she would have locked-in syndrome. She would not be able to speak or move ever again. On October 7th, the day after this dire diagnosis, my mother laughed. I walked into her room, saw her gray hair soaked with sweat and plastered against the top of her head, her skin a kind of faded yellow-green, the color of a fish out of the water for too long, the bright hues disappearing at the speed of life. And my first words were, "Looking good, Mom." Her eyes rolled in mock annoyance, her lips curled into a don't-be-such-a-smart-ass expression, and she barked out a hoarse chuckle. An hour or so after that, she crooked the index finger of her left hand, the right one was curled up in a rigid fist against her body, motioning me to come closer. "A lot of shit," she managed to whisper. The day after that, she began physical and speech therapy. Several days later, she was moved to a rehabilitation center where she didn't just have to learn how to walk and talk again. The therapist had to teach her how to swallow and eat and drink. Their prediction, she would never be able to go home. On December 18th, 5 weeks or so after she entered the facility, I managed to take her out of the rehab center in a wheelchair with the help of my lifelong friend Paul Eagle. I probably should say barely managed to, because it was as if two of the Three Stooges had been put in charge of this maneuver, and unfortunately, we were Larry and Curly. We didn't even have Moe's mental dexterity. Forget about getting her in and out of the chair and in and out of the car. We couldn't even figure out how to fold the wheelchair and stick it in the trunk. My mother marveled at our ineptitude the entire way, but somehow we moved her from West 110th Street to West 84th Street so she could attend an annual Christmas party thrown by our close friends Kathleen Maloney and Dominic Abel. My mom hadn't missed one of their seasonal bashes since she'd moved to New York over a decade earlier. She would not allow me to wheel her into the party. She refused to enter like that. She insisted on walking in, which, with some assistance, is exactly what she did. She had dinner, participated in the evening's conversation. She mostly listened, I don't want to make her sound like some kind of superhero, and took some pleasure in being the center of attention. Toward the end of the evening, Dominic ceremoniously brought out his glorious special dessert, which he makes every year for the party, a mound of croquembouche, pastry cream-stuffed profiteroles piled high into a cone-like mound and linked with crunchy strands of caramel. My mother was the only other person I knew who ever made them. Every Halloween, while most kids got Snickers and jelly beans from the neighbors, my mom made croquembouche, and that's what she passed out to the small ghosts and princesses and aliens who knocked on her apartment door. As Dominic approached with the tray, my mom took one of the doughy balls very carefully with her left hand, her right hand and most of her right side were basically still useless at this point, and bit into it. I remember the look on her face as the taste resonated, and I watched her lick a dab of the custard that had settled on her upper lip. Our eyes met, and although she didn't utter a word, I knew what she was saying to me. This is why I refused to die. The other image is from the late 1970s, a couple of years after another life-changing event. At the age of 53, she had taken her first ever real job, a low-level one, in a fancy Los Angeles restaurant. I knew that she was quite suddenly immersed in a whole new understanding of and appreciation for food chefs and cooking, but I had yet to see any manifestation of that. I was in LA on my first business trip there from New York, and, not secure enough to trust that my company would actually fork out the dough to pay for a hotel room, I was reduced to staying with my parents. They lived in a beautiful 1920s Spanish-style house above Mulholland Drive with a glittering airplane view of the San Fernando Valley. Coming straight from the airport, I pulled my rent-a-wreck car into their driveway and, small canvas suitcase in hand, went through the gate that led to the patio off the garage, then through the side door that opened into the kitchen. I stepped inside to see my mother, her back to me, preparing something on the well-worn tiled counter that snaked around most of the room. I'm not sure what she was making, but it was something substantial and weighty. An onion, perhaps, or carrots or potatoes. She was chopping, the way a real chef does, slicing down rapidly and efficiently with the knife in her right hand, effortlessly guiding the blade with her left, making sure the sharp edge could only come up against her knuckles and not cut into her skin. She didn't immediately notice that I was there, so for several moments I was able to watch her closely. Displaying a remarkable sense of ease and comfort, she was at peace while she chopped. But there was also something more than that. She was in total command of this small and immediate world. Her movements showed a supreme confidence, a subtle but sublime control of her actions. I had never seen this sort of satisfaction emanating from my mother before, and I realized for the first time that I had never quite understood her. There were layers I had missed and a depth that had been kept hidden from me. My father was the dominant personality in our family. He was the public success, the one with the large ego, and our gregarious link to the outside world. But I had never observed this kind of quiet confidence in my father. He always seemed to be shadowed by doubt, and just beneath the surface, was clearly engaged in some sort of internal struggle. After a few moments, my mother heard me, or maybe just sensed my presence, turned and smiled. She put down her knife, wiped her hands instinctively on her apron, and kissed me on the cheek to say hello. Moments later, my father came downstairs to greet me with his usual effusiveness and edgy affection. I went up to my old room to shower, change, and unpack. My dad headed back to his electric typewriter to continue working, and my mom continued preparing dinner. Even though I was now a bit of an outsider in their world, even though we were all well aware that my return was brief and temporary, life for the rest of that afternoon and evening was as it always had been. Except I knew that somehow it really wasn't. It is never easy to find comfort, not the kind that is lasting and true, not the kind that confronts reality head-on rather than seeking to disguise it. Faith is not comfort as far as I'm concerned. Faith is all about hoping to find comfort. I prefer something that will do me some good in the here and now, but the world does not seem to be designed that way, at least for most people. My mom has most definitely never been most people. In the early fall of 2014, I got a phone call from my mother, who had recently turned 92. I could tell from her tone that she wanted to discuss something a bit more serious than the oversalted soup her aide had made or the tasteless tomatoes bought at the supermarket. After her stroke in 2007, my mom couldn't cook anymore. A genuine lessening of the quality of her life, since cooking was a true and valued personal pleasure, not just a professional one. But her superb palate was unchanged. Her ability to distinguish between good and not-so-good food was probably more important to her than at any point in her life. So not long after her stroke, I arranged to have a young chef, a lovely woman named Jenny Chang, who had recently graduated from cooking school in New York, spend one day a week cooking for my mom. Jenny soon realized that my mother was more than just a passive diner. Her knowledge of food was extensive, and she loved to pass.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?